This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod. George Pell, acquitted in the High Court, freed from jail for Easter. But will the Cardinal return to power in the global Catholic Church?
Cardinal Pell's position at the Vatican at the head of the Secretariat for the Economy has been filled. The Pope appointed a new official to that position, so there's no position for Cardinal Pell to return to. It's hard to imagine that they would create a new position for Cardinal Pell.
That's ahead on the show. We'll also be speaking with someone who's known George Pell for 40 years. And the Palestinian Muslim who's the custodian of one of Christianity's holiest shrines. Let's start in Rome, where the Pope woke to the news that all seven judges of Australia's High Court had overturned Cardinal George Pell's conviction for the sexual abuse of two choir boys in the 1990s, acquitting him on those charges. Before he returned to Australia in 2017 to fight the charges, George Pell was one of the most senior officials in the Vatican running its finances. But what does his future now hold? Joshua McElwee is Rome correspondent for the independent newspaper, The National Catholic Reporter.
Pope Francis had his usual daily mass at Santa Marta at the Vatican. He reflected on the readings in Holy Week, which show Jesus undergoing persecution, although he was innocent. And the Pope said he wanted to pray for all people who have suffered what he called an unjust sentence because of rage, even though they were innocent. Pope didn't directly refer to Cardinal Pell, but obviously this is quite interesting that he would make this statement, and hard to believe he wouldn't have known about the overturning of Cardinal Pell's verdict.
Is it clear, even if it's not explicit from the Pope's lips, that he's referring to George Pell?
It's hard to say. I can't read his mind, but obviously this is a very loaded statement. I think many people in Australia will wonder what the Pope was meaning to say here. He didn't specifically mention Cardinal Pell, but it was made well after the news of the overturning of the verdict. It's hard to imagine the Pope has not been informed.
Does this mean there's a chance for George Pell to return to the Vatican?
That's a very difficult question because George Pell is currently 78 years old. He'll be 79 in June. A cardinal is normally well and retired when they reach 80. Cardinal Pell's position at the Vatican at the head of the Secretariat for the Economy has been filled. The Pope appointed a new official to that position at the end of last year. So there's no position for Cardinal Pell to return to. It's hard to imagine that they would create a new position for Cardinal Pell. I think at this point, I would imagine his career is mainly over and that he would be looking for a peaceful continuation of his life in retirement.
I wonder, though, because a previous pope, John Paul II, did give a job to another controversial cardinal. That was Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston. And Cardinal Bernard Law was essentially wanted by some American law enforcement authorities for questioning, not for any abuse by him, but for alleged cover-ups. And a job was found for Bernard Law. If in the case of George Pell, you've got someone whom the highest court has acquitted, is it not inconceivable that they could find even a minor position for George Pell?
Yeah, so what happened with Cardinal Law was from the Boston Archdiocese in 2002 under Pope John Paul II. Really, that's eons ago in terms of the church's understanding of the clergy sexual abuse crisis and how serious it is. At the time, church officials here thought it was an American problem, kind of overinflated, that the American media had taken too seriously. Obviously, now everyone knows that's not the case, that this is a very serious cultural problem in the Catholic Church. The Pope has said as such numerous times, and so it's taken very seriously here now in a way I don't think it was in 2002. The other factor is that, as I said, Cardinal Pell is very close to retirement age. It's hard to imagine that he would be entrusted with any new role, given the fact that he should be retired when he is 80 years old, and there's no opening for him here at the moment. I think perhaps if this High Court verdict had come a couple of years ago when Cardinal Pell when his position at the Vatican had not been filled and he was more on leave. It could have been possible for him to return, kind of finish out his work in that role until he reached 80 and then be done. But now that the role has been filled and Cardinal Pell is advancing in age, it's hard to see a scenario in which he's entrusted with any sort of role or official role here.
Given that he was such a prominent leader of conservative or very orthodox Catholicism for so long, will a particular faction of the church be celebrating, and will it in a sense feed into this ongoing tension within the Catholic world between conservatives and liberals?
I'm not sure if we'll see that kind of dynamic. What I've seen so far in responses from Catholics on Twitter is a lot of more conservative Catholics thought that Cardinal Pell had been treated very unjustly in his proceedings, that he had been kind of persecuted unfairly, and now they're claiming victory in terms of a person important to them is now being vindicated in court. I wonder a little about what this means for future cases in terms of if there are future cases of bishops or cardinals who are brought before courts in different countries, if this will be used as a model that Catholics could hold up and say that their bishop is being treated unfairly, just like Cardinal Pell was, or claiming for false accusations. And obviously all of this could be quite painful to sexual abuse survivors when they come forward and they want to be trusted and they want their word to be taken seriously. Obviously there's a danger now that people will point to this case to say that any accusation against the bishop is a false accusation.
I gather, Josh, that given this High Court decision, and it is the final Court of Appeal, so it can't go any further, that any investigation the Vatican would be doing into George Pell would now probably cease. Would that be right?
That's not entirely clear at this point. So normally it would be the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith that would look into issues such as this regarding sexual abuse accusations against a priest. Earlier, the congregation had started an investigation. I had spoken to Archbishop Charles Shikluna, who is an adjunct secretary for the congregation, but that was put on hold as they were waiting for the final verdicts from the higher courts in Australia. It's not clear that that would just go away. There's a possibility that the congregation would want to kind of continue just to either formalize the paperwork or even to consider for itself some of the questions involved in this case. But all of that is unclear at this moment, and we'll be waiting for more statements either from the congregation itself or from the press office.
You mentioned Archbishop Charles Shikluna there of Malta, appointed personally by Pope Francis. He is known as a zero-tolerance archbishop. Would he be considering the civil cases that may be brought against Cardinal Pell?
I do not know. It's just too hard to know. I don't know what files the congregation is looking at or that they were considering. Obviously, I wonder now that Cardinal Pell is not in a position of authority, if the case has a different feel than it did when he was the head of the Secretariat for the Economy. But I think, obviously, the congregation would have to take that very seriously and then would have to continue with the case.
Joshua McElwee of the National Catholic Reporter. I've recorded an interview with one of Australia's leading writers on the Catholic world, Dr. Paul Collins. He's a liberal. We'll play that interview next week, but if you want to hear it straight away, it's up on our website. Dr. Bernadette Tobin is a philosopher and ethicist. She's been a friend of George Pell for 40 years. She says the High Court's acquittal shows he was an innocent man caught in a maelstrom of anger over the very real church sex abuse crisis. She's even likened his case to others involving unproven accusations and convictions that were later overturned.
40 years ago, Lindy Chamberlain was accused and convicted of first-degree murder of her baby girl. How did it come to that? My guess was that in that case, it had something to do with how many people found her behaviour rather odd. Perhaps it had something to do with her unconventional religious beliefs. I'm not sure what it was, but something about her triggered a climate of hostility. Less than 10 years ago, a whole bunch of very significant, distinguished people in public life, Sir Edward Heath, Lord Jenner, Lord Britton, the head of the MI5, were accused of being part of a paedophile ring, which, amongst others, murdered one of their sexual victims. And when the police went to question one of these people, so accused Lord Bramall, Lord Bramall said, "It's clear that you, the police, believe every word this man says to be true. My difficulty is, how can I convince you that what he says is not true?" Now, again, something in the culture compelled them to believe the person. Now, again, I can only guess. I think it might have had something to do with the Jimmy Savile case, who was, you know, quite rightly accused. That might have prepared the ground. In the case of George Pell, what is it in this climate of opinion? Again, I can only speculate. He's a Catholic. That's enough for some. He's a conservative Catholic. That adds another ingredient. He's not afraid to speak his mind. Then there was the Royal Commission, which chose to focus on the Catholic Church and chose then to focus on George Pell. I think this climate of hostility runs the risk of corrupting the judgment of the reasonable person on which the law relies, and that's something that it gets from Aristotle.
Acknowledging that the High Court of Australia, the highest court, acquitted Cardinal Pell unanimously, acknowledging that, you would also be aware, and you have known the Cardinal for a long time, that outside of the allegations that were made against him, there was always a criticism of Cardinal Pell's, let us say, pastoral style. And did his very formal, often cold pastoral style contribute, though, to this public sentiment against him?
Well, Andrew, I've known him for a long time. He's a very good friend. I know him to be an honest man who steadfastly denied the allegations. And therefore, I've known for years that he's innocent of these allegations. So it's been hard, but there's been no doubt in my mind, given the man that I know. Whether personality contributes, I'm inclined to think that the factors that I just mentioned to you, those are more important ingredients, but personality often plays a role in such circumstances.
I'm just thinking, though, Bernadette, of his comment during his evidence to the Royal Commission, which had his critics infuriated, but I also know that it had many of his friends quite saddened when he referred to the case of a sexual abuse victim and he said it was a very sad story, but it was of no particular interest to me. That can't but have helped to contribute to the feeling against him in the community.
Well, viewing it in isolation, 16 hours of interrogation over four nights. That's the background. So picking that out in isolation, nothing else is remembered. And what he didn't have a chance to go on and say on that occasion was why it was that his attention wasn't focused on those things at that time.
As an ethicist, how do you balance the two sets of pain, as it were? We have the pain of a man whom the High Court has found was unjustly imprisoned. But we also have the very real pain of a group of sexual abuse survivors. Does one person's pain cancel out the other? How do we accommodate, if you like, both sets of pain?
That's not how I'd put it, Andrew. I think that the High Court has acquitted it well. It's the judicial system correcting itself. That's good. But the other difficulty is that the way the case has been conducted, I think there's a real risk that people who should come forward in the future will be disinclined to do so. That's because of the way the police conducted their investigation. When they're doing that, complainants need to get a good hearing, and the police need to provide the people they are accusing with all the evidence that can point in the other direction. So the real risk is that if the police aren't prepared to do that, because of the popular pressures on the government to punish child sex abusers, you end up not only with innocent people having their lives wrecked, but also with genuine complainants fearing that in the end their claims will be discounted or discarded. So it's really careful police work that's needed, not shoddy work which gives complainants false assurance and false hope. I really fear for them too.
That's Bernadette Tobin, an ethicist and philosopher. And you're with the Religion and Ethics Report. Easter is normally a boom time in Jerusalem. Tens of thousands of pilgrims flock to Christianity's holiest site, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Old City. It's built on the hill of Golgotha, where the Bible records Christ was crucified. Now, for the first time in living memory, the coronavirus means the church is closed for Easter. For generations, the faithful guardian of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has been a Palestinian Muslim family, the Nasebas. And I spoke recently with Mr. Waji Naseba.
Nobody enters the church, not allowed anybody to come in. Everything is empty. The old city is empty. In the morning, you can't find a cat walking in the stone.
But at Easter time, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which your family has looked after for many generations, would have what, thousands of people? What would it look like any normal Easter?
In the holiday, the Holy Saturday, over than 20,000 people coming round. They can't come to the old city. And if I want to come in inside the city, I should have a special permit. But now, no people, no pilgrims, no tourists. So everything is empty. And the people, most of them are staying home.
How does it make you feel as someone who has been the guardian of this church for all of your life?
Indeed, I'm feeling very sad to see the places empty. Everybody is sad to see all the shops, the souvenir restaurants, the streets is empty. And this time is the time for people to live in the city, to getting go to making money, no work, people stay home, and no people to come to pray, not allowed to come to pray into the church.
Is this the first time that you can remember the church not being open at Easter at all?
Sure, this is the first time in my life. It is very special days because it's Easter, the holy of the holiest day in the year for Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is one of the holy of the holiest places in the world, where the place of the crucifixion and the resurrection, and many things happened inside the church. Especially for the Good Friday, we have the last five stations of the cross, the hill of Golgotha, the tomb of the resurrection. After 2 days, people come to visit the pillar of the weeping, the flagellation pillar. So the church is closed.
How long has the Naseba family been the very faithful custodians of this church?
They start from the 7th century, when the Greek Orthodox giving the key for the family. Then Crusaders, they come, they're taking us away for 88 years, returning back by Saladin around 850 years ago, and they are inherited from father to the son.
Now, the Naseba family is a very distinguished Palestinian Muslim family. How did a Muslim family come to be trusted to be the custodians of this Christian church?
First of all, we are a people, as a Muslim, believe is Jesus is one of the holy of the holiest prophets in the world. Like equal Muhammad, Moses, Abraham, all the prophets, Adam, etc. So we are believing in the Mary, the holy of the holiest woman on the earth, more than the mother of Muhammad or his wife or sister or daughters. So if Virgin Mary, we have a special passage, a part of our Quran for the Mary, the mother of Jesus. So because of that, we're giving respect for the holy places And we are giving respect not just for the Christianity, for the Jews, we believe in the Old Testament, the New Testament, in the Quran. But we are believing is the Quran is the last book from the Lord, from God.
I think it's also that the four groups, the four Christian churches that lay claim to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Roman Catholics, the Orthodox, the Greeks, the Armenians, I think they thought that it would be good to give the custody to a neutral person. Is that right? A neutral family?
Yes, we are neutral. In the Ottoman period, the church is divided because before they having problem between the churches. If they give the key for the Latin Catholic, they will be the owner. Or if you give it to the Armenian, the same, or the Greek. So we are the neutral to give everybody the right. We opening for everybody, the church, we give them the right to making their processions, masses, etc.
I believe you have met the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Could you tell me about meeting Pope Francis?
I'm very proud to meeting him, because when he come shaking hands to me and said, look, I love the Muslims. I was laughing.
That's Waji Nasebe. He's the custodian of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And you're with Andrew West. And I do ask you just to bear with us in these times of coronavirus. I'm trying all sorts of improvising and I need to, I guess, improve my Skyping skills. So do apologise. There's only so much that our brilliant engineers can fix. And clearly that wasn't one of them. Finally today, though, thanks to coronavirus, churches are closed not just in Jerusalem, but around the world. And for practicing Christians, not being able to come together at Easter is especially painful, because Easter's also one of the few times in the year when the pews are often crowded. But after the shutdown of religious activity, it doesn't just affect the faithful. 20 of the 25 biggest welfare agencies in Australia are faith-based. And I discussed this with Professor Stephen Pickard of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture, again via Skype.
It is the case that the charities connected with the churches, and particularly its welfare agencies dealing with the homeless, youth, aged care facilities and out-of-home care, all of these things are so critical for the wider community now, and the churches are at the forefront of them. They're not-for-profits. They're there because they believe it's their mission, because the Christian tradition is a tradition of care and compassion reaching out. So if those things start to suffer in such a way that they have to be closed down, that is extremely serious for the wider community. Having said that, also, it's remarkable, and having conversations with some of my colleagues in this sector in recent times, how agile and imaginative the charities are. For example, I'm talking to a colleague who's saying that the whole question of dealing with the homeless and reaching out to those homeless, one very imaginative solution has been to put them in a hotel for self-isolation and caring for them through a means by which ordinarily they wouldn't be able to. Some other places, I think of the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, reorganized and reshaped its policies concerning staffing and how they'll go about safely caring for others within the legal framework that we have. It's a fragile place, the charities. It's not easy. It runs on the smell of an oily rag, as we say. It doesn't fit well in a market-based arrangement where the not-for-profits are usually working at the coalface of the places that are least going to ever generate money as such. So that's a real pressure. But what is the price that the community is willing to pay for care for the most vulnerable?
Well, it is the Easter week, Stephen, the holiest time for Christians. What is, if you like, the psychological effect of isolation for Christians at this most holy festival?
This is an interesting issue. In some respects, of course, the Christian community is both a gathered community and pray together, sing together, break bread together, and are reminded of their identity as the body of Christ. And so this is a real challenge. Again, a lot of creativity is starting to emerge with live worship through the magical world of Zoom. There are ways in which the community, although isolated from one another in the gathered congregation, nonetheless can be connected and reconnected in new ways. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a bishop down in Victoria a couple of days ago who said they started an online and then a Zoom service, and what they discovered was that people who hadn't been to church for a long time found a very easy mode of reconnecting in ways which ordinarily they would not have been available to them. So a strange kind of circumstances arises where people are both isolated and feel the loss of being able to gather for the key liturgical moments of the Christian year in Easter, the most sacred of times, most holy of times. On the other hand, some new ways in which people are connected. Look, the other thing very important is underlying this. The body of Christ remains the body of Christ, whether together or apart and feeling isolated. Christ comes close to all who are alone and lonely. It is fundamental that in the incarnation there is no, if you like, social distancing by the good Lord. And so there is an underlying sense of a spiritual peace and calm that I think the Christian faith wants to proclaim at this time in the season. So that dealing with panic and fear, I think there is a gospel here, good news about the way Christ is never far.
I think a lot of contemporary and evangelical styles of worship are often, though, a sort of welter of fast-moving parts. You've got the rock music, you've got the video clips, you've got the live tweeting. It kind of feeds off the energy of the crowd. Now, your job, you look at the interaction between contemporary society and Christianity. Which type of Christian expression do you think is better suited to, if you like, survive the isolation?
Well, Christianity has been deeply infected with the entertainment industry. It is actually not fit for purpose under these conditions of stress. Now, I don't want to say that some of the things that you've identified all belong to that, but there is a very strong sense of living off the crowd, so to speak, in some of the contexts of worship and Christian faith. The meditation tradition, the tradition of quiet reflection, the tradition coming deep within the resources, for instance, of my own tradition of Anglicanism, out of the Benedictine tradition of morning and evening prayer, lacking ostentatious sort of presentation, but yet speaking to the spirit and the heart of things. I think other traditions of pilgrimage, of quiet, of reflection, of waiting upon the Lord, these are peculiarly and specially relevant at times when people feel disconnected, to remember that there is the still water that goes underneath so much of the hype that unfortunately we are prone to.
That's Stephen Pickard of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture. And there's a longer version of that discussion at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage. Now, after Easter, a couple of special programs, including a look at the 40-year history of tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia in their competition for the Islamic world. That's one of the special programs after Easter. But that's it for this week. You can catch us anytime on the podcast or at iTunes, where you can leave us a rating. Thanks to Mutta Tadias and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.